1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Double 51 is our text number. Katie Hannan sitting in for Joe again this week. Now, we're going to return to a subject that we broached yesterday, a very difficult subject, perhaps one of the most difficult decisions any family or any person might have to make, because we've had a big reaction to our debate yesterday on the ethics around assisted suicide and what some listeners believe should be a right to die at a time and place of their choosing if you're living with a terminal illness. Damien, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Damien, tell me about your niece, Betty.
Well, she lives in a different country. Her mother had died when she was very young. She got married, had a couple of children, got divorced. But when, at one stage, she went and got her filling put in her teeth, and it was mercury. It was a mercury filling that then went into her body and poisoned her whole body. The end result is that she lived for about 20 years in great pain and great agony. And as I think I said to your person who rang me, she sent me a note after the wedding, because we didn't get a chance to speak at the wedding, and this is what she said to me. Last spring I had x-rays done, and I was told I was in the end stages of RA. Four limbs have no... Oh. Hello?
Yeah, I'm hearing you here, and I have you. You very kindly shared that correspondence with
do
us.
Do you want me to say it, or leave it be?
No, we're going to... I mean, we're just trying to explain the position that Betty found herself in after, as you say, 20 years of struggling with this. And she's saying in this email to you, I have a question to ask you personally. Now that you've seen me... You'd been over to visit her in Canada, hadn't you? She said, now that you've seen me, I have a hard time and I'm tired of the struggle. I've had a hard time and I'm tired of the struggle. If you were me, what would you do? And then she goes on to outline her situation, that she had had x-rays done that spring, that four limbs have no bone density. My hips are so corroded that I could have a fracture in hips as well as limbs. I can't repair the bone because I can't lift my own body weight. My doctor said I have a hole right through the left where there should be bone. I can't metabolize food. I'm sure you saw me that I ate very little. Eating food makes me spin and then throw up. They said I could have a stroke at any time, and I think this is the key line. That would be fine, other than that there is no confirming that I would die, and that's scarier. So she wrote you in these telling you all of this, and said that she had come to a decision.
Yes, she did. And I wrote back. She wanted to know what I thought about it. And I wrote back saying that I supported her decision completely.
And just to explain to listeners that that decision was to contact the Dignitas Clinic in Switzerland and to make an appointment.
She had already done that. But she just wanted to support me to say what I thought of the fact that she had made that decision and had actually made an appointment to see them.
And what did you say to her?
Well, I can say that I said to her, okay, I'll tell you here now. Again, unfortunately, I was looking at this thing. I just said, I've just read your email and I'm heartbroken. I would have liked to spend more time with you, but as I well know, you're very busy with guests. You've asked me my opinion, so here goes. As I told you, I had a medical problem myself. I said, my illness focused my mind on what could happen. I remember having to wear a catheter for a month after, and that was the worst. I've already told my children that if I got a serious illness, that I would be, I would want to do the same thing. I said, in a nutshell, I support and agree with your decision. I would like to be with you in Switzerland when the time comes, that is, if you would like me there. If your children are there, they'd be more than welcome to come back with me. And if there's anything I can do to help you or the family in any way, I will do it. Anything I can to help you.
So,
to help the children.
So, Damien, I suppose we should tell people this is going back a number of years now.
Yeah.
When you were asked to what you thought of this,
and
you say it was heartbreaking, but you had no qualms about supporting her.
Absolutely none. No. Well, how could you? Why would you want somebody to live in constant pain and constant constant trauma and see your family around you. I wouldn't want it for myself. I mean, I want to be remembered the way I am now, good and bad or whatever I am. But I don't want to be a burden on my children. I don't want to be in pain myself. For what reason? I mean, if it's irreversible, it's irreversible. I mean, why carry on if you have an alternative? Now, that's my decision. That's what I believe. Just as we had campaigns earlier on this year on other things, it's a person's own decision, the person's own right. It's nothing to do with anybody else. It's not anybody else's business, in actual fact. It's me making a decision for myself.
I'm just reading another line which jumps out from that correspondence to you at that time. It's, I'm too tired to keep fighting. I don't want my children to have to witness me in a diaper and wasting away to nothing. So that was her frame of mind as she arranged to go to Switzerland.
Yes.
You there in that letter back to her, you said you offered to be there with her. Did you go to Switzerland?
I did, yes.
Can you talk us through that? Did you travel together?
No. She came from, as I think I said, a different country, different continent. I left from Ireland. They arrived, I think, a day or two before I did. Quite frankly, she couldn't. She was very weak. She's a very religious person. She brought a Bible with her everywhere. The day before, we went on a drive around, and she really enjoyed the scenery in Switzerland, and she was really, really happy. We went out that night for dinner, and she had I always remember, she had a bit sort of like a Swiss gatto cake. And she said, my God, now it's just the first time I've been able to eat something like this in donkey's years. And then, but I was knowing that it's going to come back for me the next month and hurt me and make me sick and everything else. The next morning, we went and had coffee, which she hadn't been able to drink in years either. Then when we went to Dignitas, she did ask me to bring, and I suppose there's a good or bad advertisement from, she asked me to bring over a bottle of Bailey's Irish Cream. And when we went in, I went through all the procedures, the legal things, the videos taken, making sure that she was quite happy with it and that she wanted to carry on with this. She then said, "Can we grab? We now have a glass of babies each."
Who was there with you at that time? Who was in the room?
That was myself and herself and her friend and her two children.
Okay, and what was the atmosphere like at that stage? Because you must have known then you were very close to the end.
Somber, but she was very religious, and before we went into the room, she went out and there was a little fountain outside, a little garden, and she prayed. And one of our children went out and separated, and they prayed together. And then she came back in, as I said, and we had the glass of Bailey's. After the drug was being administered, the day after, she wanted to sit on the bed or sit on the sofa or whatever else, and I still get emotional thinking about this. Sorry.
Take your time there, Damien.
She has to sit on her son's knee, that lap. And that's where she had the medicine. And then she fell asleep. My parents died. You go through this. Everybody in life goes through that. Losing their parents or losing somebody they love. And it's going to happen to us all. And what happened to her, she died at her choosing. She was as peaceful as anything. And she just fell asleep. And quite frankly, if death can be called nice, it was a nice death. And why should somebody else, or why should any government or law or anything else tell you how you should die? It's not up to somebody else. It's your own personal choice.
It's hard though on family members. I'm just struck by that story that she asked to be in her son's arms, to be on her son's lap for her last moments in this world.
How
were her how was her son? How were her children?
They were they were as sad as they would be if they were in a hospital after suffering for 6 years or 6 months. They were devastated. Of course they were devastated. But they were there, just as we all are. When my mother and father died, I was out to hold my dad's hand, and unfortunately my mother died overnight, so I didn't get that chance. I saw her the night before. But they were able to, just as happens when people die in a hospital. The only thing that was missing was that she didn't die in pain. She didn't die completely in bits, for want of a better word. She died happy. That sounds ridiculous, I know, but that's the way it was. She died knowing that she wasn't going to be a burden, and she died knowing that she wasn't going to have any more pain. She died at a time for choosing, after having a nice time together with her family. And to me, that was beautiful. If as I said, if you can call anything like that beautiful.
And this is your niece. This is your sister's child.
Yes. Yes.
So she must have been. Was she a relatively young woman still at this stage?
Well, funny you ask. I was just thinking that this morning. I think she was born around 1957. So she would have been 53, 54, 55.
So, yeah. So you know, long before we'd all hope our time might come. But she had had 20 mm-hmm. years of this illness before
yes.
this.
Yes.
And you say she was a very religious person.
Yes,
she had her Bible with her. She prayed
always,
at the end.
Always. Other emails I didn't send you where she's saying, but she prayed for me. She prayed for me of her, and she prayed for everybody, and she was... She was a very religious person. She believed in God and the Bible. And
But, I mean, a lot of people with a strong religious belief would feel that maybe this isn't, you know, this isn't God's way, or, you know, that you are playing God yourself if you take this decision into your own hands. And I just wonder, because I know she obviously thought about this for a long time. Mm-hmm. Did she have any concerns in her own head that there might...
Absolutely none. She was going to God. That's as far as she was concerned. She was going to see her God. And that gave her great strength.
And having been in that room and seen, you know, experienced this at first hand, Damien, you are absolutely convinced, and you've spoken to your own family about your own life plans, basically, or your death plans, I should say, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And you say that this is the way it should be for you as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yes. I mean, can you imagine the alternatives? If I try to do it here, and the way things are at the moment, and anybody helps, it's a bit like allowing, as we have now, the abortion. It's like saying a person, oh yes, you can have abortion, but by the way, any nurse that helps, any doctor that helps you, any family member that helps you or operates or something, they'll all go to jail. It's absolutely ridiculous. And what's the alternative for me? Walk up the road and throw myself in the canal?
Well, I mean, I suppose we should say, as a lot of people will be listening and say, well, the alternative is to deal with the suffering, to deal with, you know, to let life run its course. Some people
absolutely, they have every right to say that and believe it. But why should they tell me to do that?
And your family, they support you and your view on this?
100%. Yes. They know how strongly I feel about it, and I very said it in no uncertain terms, and my family do not, yes.
And I suppose then the question comes, like, what would constitute that moment where you say, okay, this is enough, enough is enough?
Well, if a doctor said to me, you've got this illness, it's going to be very debilitating, you're going to end up probably in some hospital or a nursing home or whatever else. You're going to have pain. You're not going to be able to do anything. You can't do anything whatsoever. And by the way, it's going to cost you so much per week or whatever else. And I say, how long? They say 6 months. And I say, well, how long before it becomes debilitating? And they say 2 months or whatever else. I listen to what the doctor has to say. And then I say, okay, I'll carry on for 2 months. And I'd rather have my game of golf if I can do that. But the day I can't play my game of golf, or I can't go read a book or watch a television or enjoy my life, what's the purpose of life if you can't enjoy it, if you can't be there? And you know it's not going to change. If there's if you know it's not going to change, and you know it's going to you're finished. And let's be honest, we all know we're going to be finished. We just don't know when.
But I suppose what we don't know is how we would feel at that moment, that maybe we would have a different perspective on what, you know, quality of life we would be glad to accept, you know, in other circumstances.
And for anybody who feels that way, good for them. It's not. And will I change my mind? I don't know. Nothing has happened to me. All I'm saying is I should have the choice. I'm not asking anybody else to do it. I'm not asking anybody to do anything. I'm just saying, hang on. Let's put it this way. I'm pro-choice, okay? It's as simple as that. It's my choice.
Okay.
Not anybody else's.
Damien, please stay with us because you do have a very particular perspective on this. I want to bring in Sean.
Sheehan, how are you?
Sheehan, sorry, Sheehan. Apologies. You were listening to Damien there.
Yeah, and I mean, how can you really disagree with anything that Damien has said? Because it's all coming from a place that makes a lot of sense and a very kind place. But my concern with this, my grandfather lived with us for 16 years until he died. And it was a huge privilege for us to have in the house. And none of the care responsibilities fell on the kids. It was all on my mum and my dad and a professional carer and other family members. But that experience has always made me think about, with this issue, I'd be worried about vulnerable older people being coerced or feeling under pressure to make this decision, even sometimes when that pressure might be imagined. I actually don't know how you solve the problem, because it is unjust for somebody to be suffering to that degree and to be looking at down the road getting worse and not be able to do anything about it. But I don't know how you protect those other people.
Yeah, I know. We this came up in our debate yesterday as well. There, a lot of people have concerns that, as you say, these people, elderly, vulnerable people, might not even be being put under pressure, but might, you know, get the notion into their heads and feel that their time had come maybe too soon.
Can I answer that?
Sure. Yeah.
Look, Brendan, the guy, the TD in Waterford, who put forward a bill that ran out of time in the dog. In that bill, he has protections and, well, what other word I'm trying to think of, various systems put in place that you have to go through certain steps before you can go ahead and get this done. It's not a case of, I'll ring up tomorrow and get it done and go in like you're getting a toothache or something like that. There will be protections and everything else for people there. And everything changes. We all know this. But if a person reaches a stage like my niece did, and like as far as I am concerned, if you've gone through all these things and you're mentally capable of making this decision, then it's your right to do it. There's always pressures. There's pressures on everything, no matter what it is. But it comes down. I keep on saying this word, and I have to say it yet again. It's my choice. And it's lovely to hear a person say they look after somebody for 16 years. I wouldn't want anyone looking after me for 16 years or 6 years or 2 years. I want to be independent. And if it's my decision then to say no, that's my decision.
Okay, Sian, come back in. Yeah, please.
Can I get in there? Yeah, when I say there's a bit of an echo on the line, so it's a bit difficult to talk. I didn't have to look after, in quotation marks, my grandfather. That a lot of that fell later in life to my parents and the professional carer and aunts and uncles. But it wasn't like all misery for that 16 years. We had a great time together, and it was only in the last few years that it was actually very, very difficult for my grandfather. And there were times that my heart did go out to him, and he had had enough. And then he did bounce back again. And then, you know, he'd go downhill again. So he went through kind of phases. But when he did bounce back, say, for example, now, there was a time we thought he was going to pass, and he bounced back, and he had a summer in Wicklow with another part of the family, with my uncle. And he got to spend time with my youngest cousin that he never really had with my youngest cousin because he was kind of so far behind the rest of us in years. And that was invaluable to my youngest cousin and to him, I'm sure, even though it was probably excruciating for him. And I think, sorry, what's your name?
That was Damien you were talking to there.
Damien, it is your choice, and that's the beauty of it for you. And my concern is that it would always be everybody's own choice. That's what it should be, but I don't know how you... Now, you were saying that there's measures put in place, if there are, and if it can be figured out, brilliant. But that's my concern about it.
If you go on, there's a website, and I honestly can't remember the name, but you had the gentleman on yesterday who was Tom Corn? Yeah, Tom Corn. Yeah. I spoke to him as well. They've drafted all this thing together to make exactly that sort of thing. It's not beyond the bounds of human ingenuity to sit down and write out a bill that will protect vulnerable people or people who could be forced or anything else. Well, all I'm talking about is just as we had in the pro-choice campaign, there are things put in there, protections, etc., for everything and everybody. But what is not there, what's disgraceful, is that somebody else can tell me that I should or live in agony or whatever else for a moment, for months in time or years in time, and not have a choice to make myself what I want to do.
Okay.
Why should somebody else tell me that?
Okay, Damien, please stay with me. If we can keep everyone, stay with us, please, because we want to continue this debate after these.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And we're sticking with this debate on this very difficult subject. Sheehan, can I just ask you there, what Damien was saying there, that, you know, that we can legislate for this, that you can put protections into legislation if you were to introduce that choice, but that it's fundamental that people should have that choice. Can you accept that? Or?
Yeah, my point of view isn't kind of, this is what I believe. What I would love to hear is a reason why I don't need to worry about that. So if there's a way that legislation could be put in place to protect vulnerable older people from feeling under pressure to make this decision, whether it's real or imagined, then that's brilliant.
I can actually answer that, I think, if I'm just looking at something I had here. I can find it now, sorry. There are two things, or a number of things you can look at. Just give me a moment. Yeah, if you look at the Oireachtas.ie, EN Bill, Bills Bill 2015-125.
I suppose we should explain to people, Damien, this bill is no longer live such because it was introduced in the last Dáil and it didn't progress.
It ran out of time, yeah.
And it was John Halligan, who is now a minister, of course, introduce private members' legislation himself.
So there are, and if you go on to the internet, you'll find loads of things, and especially the report on the right to die with dignity. If it's that.ie. Dáil 32 Joint Committee on Justice and Equality reports 2018, even reporting the right to die with dignity. So there are things there, and you can look up the bill. You can see what the protections are. You can see what they're saying. And it's about being caring for people who want to have their own choice.
But I suppose, Damien, what Sheehan is saying there, that with all the best will in the world and the best legislation in the world, is there any real, watertight legislation or situation that can guarantee that nobody's ever going to feel they're in a position where they are pushed into making this decision?
Kathy, is there anything in this world, any legislation ever being produced, that 100% guarantees 100% of everything? No. All you can do is do the best you can, and you'll always find exceptions. People will always try to get around things. But that's, again, part of legislation, if it can be proven that somebody was or is going to be pushed in any way, shape or form, it's part of the protections.
Okay.
Of course there has to be protection.
Okay, Damien. Stay with us. I want to go to Pat. Pat, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, Pat, you have another perspective on this from your own family experience.
Well, basically, for the past 15 years with three elderly family members who have at this stage died, I was 15 years in and out of at home first. I was a principal carer, and for the rest of the time in and out of care homes of various sorts. Now, I'd have to say the care homes were excellent.
So is this your parents who were getting on in years?
My parents and an uncle, yes.
And an uncle, okay. And so you cared for them at home for some time, and then ultimately they ended up in care homes?
Well, they ended up in care homes when they couldn't be lifted in final stage Parkinson's, had to have permanent hospital. The other condition, I don't know what the condition was, but the gentleman in question was over 90. The ages went from 84 to 95. Now, one of my parents had final Parkinson's, the other had vascular dementia and some Alzheimer's diagnosis. But I find it quite frankly appalling that it appears, listening to the show, that people don't actually seem to have a very good realization of what type of VESTA applies in many end-of-life conditions, especially where people don't achieve death when they perhaps ought.
You're saying how bad it can get for somebody, basically?
It can get very bad. For instance, either two of the three will have spent about 5 years being hoisted in and out of bed, being nappied, being spoon-fed, was confused a lot of the time. Now, there was no bouncing back out of this, and there were no happy moments. You know, I want to be very clear on that. This notion about the little old person sitting at the fireplace and all that didn't exist.
But, I mean, we heard from Sheehan there, and they did have an experience of her grandfather, in her case, who did go down, and at one time she said actually thought he was going to pass away, but he rebounded and did, you know, have some good quality of life. But you're saying that doesn't always happen.
That is not the experience of everyone. And it's not the experience of... It's an experience. Of course it is, and that does happen. I've witnessed it myself and others. But it's not everyone's experience.
And it wasn't your experience with your family.
It wasn't mine, and quite frankly, as I said, I was in and out of care homes for 15 years. You meet quite a lot of other people, and especially when there's Alzheimer's or something like that involved, you meet a lot of people, and we do tend to talk and discuss. And I would know people who were in beds in care homes for eight years or more. Now, the care home was excellent, and the staff... Like, I come from an inspectorial background, and I would be watching things. And I didn't have a row in either of the three care homes I dealt with, two in Ireland and one in the UK, in all of that period.
But
care homes are fine. Yes, of course, some people, I've had relations who actually got sick on a Thursday. Well, the person was a young person, only 98. And was dead on a Friday. And that was a beautiful death. Like, we are all going to die. Mm-hmm. Perhaps some like me won't, but... and I've got a bus pass, incidentally.
But you're saying, having witnessed what were your own relatives, your parents, your uncle, and what you saw in terms of what the situation people are left in care homes, with the best will in the world, that they have, as you say, like no quality of life, or even, you know, apparent awareness of their surroundings. You're saying that you wouldn't, the people don't realise that might be what's facing them.
The care homes, they can't do miracles. My mother, in her lucid moments, and my father also, and my uncle also, they expressed their desire not to continue with the existence. Mm-hmm. Now, they expressed it to me personally. They also expressed it in my presence to others. Now, it was extremely painful.
Did they mean, I mean, in a sense that you felt that they genuinely meant it, that they did not want to carry on?
They didn't want to carry on. There's no doubt about that. My father even mentioned the graveyard, that he'd be better off there. He'd prefer to be there. Mm-hmm. He couldn't go on with this anymore. Took four people to put him into bed, four people to take him out.
Shocking.
There was pain and suffering. There was bowel blockages. There were, you know, there's a lot of problems that people who don't mm-hmm. have hands-on experience don't seem to take into account. Those are details, but by God, they're significant details. But if you don't have the hands-on experience, you don't take them into account. You can't. Now, the one fear I have is that it could happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
I could be the person trapped for 6 years in a big chair in a care home. Now, quite frankly, as I said, the care home was excellent. And I would advertise the care home. I would actually mention it, but I don't think that's allowed. But the point is this, that there was no, and the staff in both countries, all three care homes, were excellent. As I said...
Can I come back to the point is that you wouldn't want it for yourself, and you don't want your children, you don't want your children to see you that way. I don't want to be that way. And I should have the right to make the decision. It shouldn't be up some archaic law to tell me that I should or shouldn't do it. Or it's even worse, the system they have at the moment where you can commit suicide, but if anybody even tries to help you, that they can go to jail. It's absolutely ludicrous.
Okay, Pat, I want to bring in Mary. Mary, good afternoon to you.
Yeah, but if you have Alzheimer's, Mary, and I would not like my grandchildren
to see you.
Coming in. I want them to remember me as I am.
Yeah. You see my aunt now, and...
Yeah, look at her.
Yeah, but sure.
You know, and she's lying there a vegetable.
She didn't know.
Mary, are you with us?
Yes, Katie.
Yeah, you've been listening to the conversation there with Pat and Damien.
I have, yes. Yeah.
You're not in the first flush of youth yourself at the moment, Mary.
Pardon?
You're not in the first flush of youth. Am I allowed to say that?
Oh, yes, you are, Andy. No. Anything but, I think I told you yesterday, my age. No, but I'm very healthy, though.
Okay. And what's your view of this?
My view is that I think it definitely should be brought in, that people should have the choice. I said, I certainly, if I got Alzheimer's or something like that, I certainly would not like my grandchildren to come in and I not knowing them. You know, I want them to remember me and all the good, nice times we had together and to have those memories. Yeah. Also, I'm very independent, so I mentally couldn't stick somebody looking after me. Once I'm not able to, I think it should come in.
Yes.
People should have the choice.
Yes.
Is it something that you think
carers,
about? Yeah.
When you hear about carers, what they have to put up with, you know, what they have to go through and looking at maybe their parents or someone. I mean, that's agonising on anyone.
Can I bring in just one other point as well, and maybe I shouldn't, but I will. It's about the financial aspect of it. I've worked hard all my life, and I've saved a few quid, and I have my own house. I want to be able to leave that to my children. I don't want to have to spend it on some healthcare place and, you know, to live for another 6 months in agony. I suppose that's the bottom line, I suppose, I'm saying. I know it shouldn't have anything to do with finance, but sometimes it's a consideration. I want to be able to let my children see me and remember me exactly as I am and hopefully leave something for them to be able to go out and have a party after I take the bucket.
Pat.
On the issue of the finance and the choice, I find that my parents and indeed my uncle were of a view that they were a terrible burden. And in their lucid moments, they weren't actually doolally. And they did realise they were. And it was very painful to realise that no amount of soft talk or reassuring would take that awful feeling away from them. Like they could see the extent of input. And they were frightened, they were sickened by it.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is this, that if I were in their shoes, I would equally be. As for the cost was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Now, there's opportunity cost, and if that's weighted in, It's really phenomenal, but it's totally unnecessary. Like, we're all going to die.
But I suppose, yeah. Pat, I'm conscious that there will be people out there who would say they would pay anything, give anything for another hour with the person that they loved. And
but then again, if that person is in solid pain and that person doesn't wish to be there,
yes.
Then quite frankly, I think there's something wrong with that remark. I think it's very unsound.
So you think that it would be that would come from a selfish place if somebody was hanging on to somebody because they couldn't bear to let them go?
Well, either that poor person has been very selfish or has been very illogical.
I would agree to completely there. It's you know, I would love to have my parents back, but it's not going to happen. You know, they're going to die, I'm going to die, we're all going to die. Let us die at least with dignity and peace. If that's your choice, if somebody else wants to do something else, completely okay by me. But nobody should tell me what I should do.
Okay, stay with us, Damien. Fionnuala Shanahan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, how are you? I'm a healthcare professional and I'm working in a different area, but I've worked in every area of nursing. And I did a healthcare end-of-life thesis on advanced directives in living wills. And it was based on autonomy and capacity. So it's respecting the choices of people. So you're allowed to make a choice when you're in your sound health about what you eat, where you go, what you do. Why, when you get older, should that be taken from you?
I feel that respecting
people's choices is what matters here.
Can I ask you, the advanced care directives, are they valid in the HSE? No.
They're not. But you can draw up a document. One of our lecturers wrote a book, Let Me Decide. And in the event of you having a very severe illness or something happening, you can lay down in advance what you would and wouldn't want done in terms of intervention.
Well, can you maybe just give us a sense of what you can actually say you don't want done or you do want done? I mean, what types of treatments?
Let's suppose you had a life-limiting illness, right? And you're admitted to hospital and you're saying, well, I don't want to be peg-fed. If I have a cardiac arrest, I don't want to be resuscitated, because we do have DNR, do not resuscitate orders in hospitals. And those decisions are made by consultants. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, this person would be making a choice if they had a life-limiting illness while they're in their full capacity. And the decision would be made with two medics who have no vested interest in terms of they have nothing to gain from the demise of this person.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's what I would want for myself. Again, as I heard that gentleman say, I wouldn't want to be a burden on my family.
No.
In that instance as well. And having worked all my life, I want the same choice that I make to work or not to work. And I feel I would respect fully, and have done all my life, people who want to keep going, want to have as much intervention. That's their choice.
Mm-hmm.
But also we should be respecting the choices of people that don't want that intervention.
It strikes me, Fionnuala, though, if you have, say, for instance, an advanced care directive saying you don't want to be peg-fed, that could very, very much hasten your end of life, could it not, if you
absolutely
ended up in that scenario?
But is
that respected within the health service here?
Well, you see, I suppose it's going to come down to whom you're dealing with and who's the advocate for the patient. My elderly mother, Lorna Mercer, died recently. Well, it's now 2 years ago. But she died at home in the fullness of her health with my sister and I, who looked after her, because we had wonderful support from our GP and services, and she was brilliant. But I just feel that why shouldn't everyone have the right to make that choice when it comes to the end of their life?
Okay, stay there, Fionnuala, because I want to go to Joe, who has a story to tell us about an advanced care directive. Good afternoon, Joe.
Good afternoon. My wife died in November 2017. There, she had cancer and I'd come back a second time after 8 years. You know, she had breast cancer first and then came back in the ovaries. And I suppose for the last 5 years of her life, she was struggling and suffering quite a lot with pain, because she used to have a lot of bowel obstructions and eventually there was a tumour in the abdomen as well, near the liver also. And she had an advanced healthcare directive done about 3 months before she died, because she was in such pain. She was sitting on the commode at home, because I took her home for the last 6 weeks of her life, and there was a palliative care nurse with us, and she said, it's a palliative care nurse, I don't want to be resuscitated if it comes to that. Mm-hmm. You know, and now I had no part in it. I told her I can't influence you one way or the other, whether you want that or not. So we had to get on to the GP, and we followed through on that, and she had it done. It was very emotional. I mean, she started crying while she was doing it, you know. And no, I put it this way. I didn't want her to die. Of course, I'd give anything to bring her back. Of course, you can't get the person back. But again, I'd be fully in support of choice. I mean, I don't think any one of us, I know this might sound a bit funny, but any one of us did not choose to come into the world, and I don't think anybody should stop us from leaving when we want to leave. That's my honest opinion on it, you know.
I was always
in favour of it for a long time anyway, and I'm glad
I couldn't agree with you more. I think there comes a time, and it's again respecting what that person's wishes are. It mightn't be what you want, but then it's not about you. It's about them.
Exactly. And yet, the other side of that then was, I mean, I was told by some of the palliative care nurses after she died, and a palliative care counsellor as well, that she didn't want to leave me at all. She fought it to the very end at the same time. I suppose that's part of the struggle with her as well. She didn't want to leave me this.
And Joe, can I ask you in your case? And I'm conscious that it's still quite recent. And it must be still quite raw for you. But there was no suggestion of any assisted dying scenario being discussed. This was something different. This was, if I get to this stage, you know, make any extraordinary attempts to keep me going, basically.
Exactly. Any intervention like surgery or resuscitation, none of that. I remember actually that there was a person came to the house, a physiotherapist at one stage, because my wife's cancer went to her hip, and she had to have a hip replacement. That was about 5-6 months before she died, because it was spreading at that stage, you see, quite rapidly. And I remember asking the physiotherapist, because she was a Dutch woman, and I was always curious about euthanasia and assisted dying. And she said to me, her grandmother had it in Holland. Now, I'm only saying this because that's what she told me, and that she said it's a choice. And that was always my opinion of it as well. That was a choice. You know, I mean, if people have the choice to live, I mean, surely they must have a choice to leave themselves go, especially if they're suffering. You know, it has changed my whole perspective as well since my wife died. I mean, before she died, I was of that opinion, but since she died, I suppose it has made it stronger for me, because this is different, I know. I mean, I'm not sick myself, terminally ill or anything, and I'm not depressed, I'm not suicidal, I have no intention of harming myself or anything, but my whole world has changed since she died, because she was the only person in my life that there's nobody else left. And I suppose if I was sick in the morning, it wouldn't bother me in the least. But that's a different issue, I know, but it has changed my whole perspective on, I mean, death is, everyone said, it's going to happen to all of us. To me, it's just a passage, whatever you believe in. It's just something that happens to all of us, it's part of nature.
Okay, please stay with us, Joe. I want to continue this discussion, but I need to take another break now. 51551 is our text number.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
And you're welcome back. We were talking to Joe there, who lost his wife to cancer in 2017. Joe, you're saying that changed your perspective, but you're saying that it's because you have nobody else to worry about now, in a sense, in terms of your own death.
Yeah, I suppose like one of the GPs in my own local surgery, I suppose, like I was with her back there in June, actually, and it was just for a neck problem. I had a little bit of arthritis in the neck. And I just broke down crying in front of her. I suppose I was only in the door about a minute. And I said, my heart is broken. I said, I can't go on anymore. And I'm not a bit depressed. I'm not a bit suicidal. I mean, it doesn't cross my mind at all. And she put it to me this way. She was a very, very supportive, very compassionate doctor. And I suppose she had to be careful, naturally, because of the law the way it is at the moment. But she put it this way to me. And that was that, you know, doctors want to keep people alive. We want to keep people in comfort, of course, naturally. But you're the one that must go through it. And she said, you did go through this with your wife. Because, I mean, I was there with her. I mean, matter of fact, the last thing I said to her was, I said, I still love you, Eileen. I said, I put my hand on her face. And she took three gasps. She had the oxygen mask on her. And she said, I love you. And she just head bowed and she died. And I suppose for me, it was like the clock stopped when she died. I mean, I my life just shut down like the curtain is down in a show, you know. That's the way I felt.
And, it, and as you say, it was just the two of you.
It was just the two of us, and I suppose it was a long journey that I was looking after for a long time. And I suppose in particular, you see, it's very hard to explain. I suppose for me, it was like me going with her. I remember carrying her out the door that following evening. I left her in the house for 18 hours laid out when the night nurse went away, and somebody else came just to stay with me during the night. No sleep, of course, naturally, but it was up all night. But the following evening, when I had the undertaker up, I put her on a stretcher and put her into the hearse outside the house. And to be honest with you, I said it to one or two therapists that I see there in the last 12 months, that when I brought her out into the hearse, I felt I went with her, but my physical side came back. Spiritually, I was gone away. That's how I felt, and that's how I feel. I feel I'm just living at the moment in the sense of existing, really, just waiting for myself. It doesn't bother me in the least. I mean, it's not depression. I'm not a bit depressed, to be honest with you.
Has it gotten any better? I mean, you've been talking to people. You've been trying to work through your situation, and I think anyone can hear from what you're saying that you're in a very tough place. But is it getting better, Joe, do you think?
I find as time goes on, it hits me more in the sense that this is real. This is not something like somebody gone away for a few weeks or a few months and, you know, they might come back. This is for real. And it makes me feel very empty, and I don't know how to describe it, but it's like, again, as I said earlier on, my perspective on death has completely changed. It's no longer this barrier. It's like somebody saying, don't go into that room. You're not supposed to. The door is locked. And I've unlocked it and said, it's okay. There's nothing to be afraid of. If I was told in the morning I had a few months to live myself, it wouldn't bother me in the least. I wouldn't be very sad over it, and I wouldn't be very frightened, I don't think.
I'm sure there's people in your life, though, Joe, that would be.
Again, for me, that goes back to choice, to see, in the sense of that, like, other people that would be in my life, like relations, they're living their life. Like the doctor said to me, we want to save lives, part of our job, but you're the one that must go through what you're going through. You see, the shoe is on the other foot, how the other person feels. I mean, I feel very strong about that. I mean, you can't live somebody else's life. You know, and if somebody has that state of mind, I mean, that's the way they are. I mean, as I say, I've seen a few doctors since my wife died, and, you know, I'm not a bit depressed, not a bit suicidal. I'm just, as I say, my perspective has changed. I suppose it's very difficult to understand if you're not in the situation, I suppose. I don't know. But when you feel that the only person you had is gone, and there's a big vacuum, and it's just yourself, you know, it's a different scenario, you know. But
you sound like you're a relatively young man, Joe. Are you, from your voice?
I'm 65 now, since July. Yeah,
you've a lot of living left, Joe.
Yeah, people have said to me, you know, I suppose one person said to me 12 months ago, God, you could live for another 20 years. I said, I don't want to live for 20 years. I said, I don't want to end up, I said, on my own at 80. I said, with a stick maybe, or hobbling around the house. I said, I don't want that at all. I said, that's not... It might be okay for other people to say that to see, and they might give you a medal for it, but the medal is not much good if you're hobbling around on your own. It doesn't bother me. I suppose, again, to say, I go back to perspective. It has totally changed my perspective. It's not gloomy for me to say that. It's not a dark place to be. Depends how you see that.
You do sound quite very matter-of-fact. I want to put that to Bridget. Bridget, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Katie.
Yeah, were you listening to Joe there?
Yes.
And, you know, he's had obviously the most difficult personal experience, and he's now, as I say, quite matter of fact about his view of this. What's your view on it?
I just maybe missed the start of it there. Is he talking about assisted suicide?
Well, he's saying that death doesn't bother him, basically. Is
oh,
that
yes, yes. Well... As a matter of fact, death doesn't bother me either, because I believe in God, and I believe that, you know, I believe in the written word, and I know that when you accept the Lord as your Saviour, you're not afraid of death anymore. Death has no more hold over you.
What about the issue that we have been talking about, of assisted suicide?
No, I'm totally opposed. Well, I'm totally opposed. It's against the idol. It's against God's law. And I know I'm going to offend people, you know, because some people don't believe that. And I think that assisted suicide is wrong. One of your listeners said there that, you know, that none of us choose to come into this world. Therefore, it's not up to us to choose to leave it. It's not our right. It's not our entitlement. It's not our choice. It's up to God at the end of the day. There are excellent palliative care in place in hospitals and in hospices. And that's what I want to say. And I'm blessed that I don't have any debilitating illness, thank God.
But maybe you have a faith, obviously, Bridget, and you believe. Yes. But what if you don't believe?
I just feel sorry for people that have no hope.
But you say you still don't think they should be have this choice?
For people that don't believe in God, I mean, I don't think it should be brought in at all, because one of your previous listeners there, a lady, said that, you know, it could easily be abused, you know, in regard to elderly people.
Sorry.
Yeah.
This whole thing about abuse, the bottom line is we're talking about putting in safety nets to make sure that doesn't happen.
This is but Damien.
That lady says it's you know, that she doesn't believe in it, and that's fine. And in a society like we have, we try to do what's right for everybody, but you've also got to take into account the rights of minorities or majorities or whatever. So I have a right to make that decision for myself. I'm not asking you not to believe in God. Oh, that's God's word, which I could argue with, because the word of God was probably written by some man in America about 2,000 years ago and been interpreted all the way through. I don't know anywhere that says you can't die at your own time. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But the bottom line is, I should have the right to make that decision for myself. I'm not asking you to do it. I'm not asking you to do anything about it. I'm just asking you to allow me to make my decision in my beliefs. And not to make me suffer if I don't want to suffer. If I want to finish my life after a reasonable time, I don't want to die. I've had prostate cancer. I've had treatment for it. I've had an operation for it. And I go to see my doctor here. And if something comes up, I go and get another treatment. Because I can still go around and enjoy my life. But if a time comes where I cannot enjoy my life, where I become a burden on my children, where I become a pain in the backside to everything and everybody, more than I am at the moment, I want to be able to have the choice to say, look, it's time to go. And that should be my right.
Yeah, but Damien, you kind of speak there as if you don't believe in life after death either.
Oh, of course I do. But why would you say I don't believe in life after death?
Well, if you believe in life after death, would you believe in heaven?
I believe in heaven, yes.
And hell?
I don't necessarily believe in hell. I don't know. I don't think God would ever believe in hell. I don't think about it that much, to be honest with you. Frankly, I know when I die, I'm going to be buried with my parents. And one of the things I would love to be able to think is that I'd meet my parents again. And that's me and my belief. If somebody else doesn't believe that, good luck to them. Nobody should tell me what I should believe in or what I should do or what I shouldn't do. All I'm saying is allow me the freedom and the liberty to make a decision for my body and my life that suits me.
Okay.
I'm not asking you to do it. I'm asking you allow me to do it.
Okay, we have that point. Now, Damien, Bridget, what do you say to that?
Well, I just feel sad about it, to be honest. Look, I think we're going to agree to differ here, because my creator is God. He's you know, you have two masters on this earth. You either follow the devil or you follow God. There's no in between. We don't have right over our own bodies.
But why do you say I'd follow the devil by saying what I'm doing?
Well, I believe in heaven and hell, and I believe that this earth, as we know it now, is being run by the devil. Look at all the murders. Everything that's happening in the world today, he's rubbing his hands in glee.
But we've always had murders. We've always had problems like that. This is not
where do you think it comes from? It doesn't come from God.
So, but what's that got to do with me?
It comes from the lack of believing in God and from the lack of faith. Our faith is our only hope.
Okay. You're delighted to believe in that, and that's grand. All I'm saying to you, if I believe that it's my right, under God, or whatever else, to finish off my life rather without pain, and at a time when God has already dictated, if you want to use it, that I'm going to die, what is the difference to you, me, or anybody else, if I decide I'm going to go a week earlier, or 2 weeks earlier, or a month earlier?
Okay.
It makes absolutely no difference to me.
Well, then you should allow me to do it.
Yes, well, that is your decision. If that's your decision, then I'm not, or nobody else is going to stop you. But I'm only telling you of, you know, where I stand on it.
Okay.
I'm not.
But what you're saying, though, that if it came to legislation, that you would go against it.
I would, of course.
Yeah, you see, you're saying of course. But, I mean, if you really believe in God knowledge, you'd also believe in charity and mercy. And you'd believe that people have different perspectives to you, and you should respect that, and that God certainly has given us all different views.
But I don't believe in it, so why would I vote it in? I wouldn't vote in anything that I don't believe in or that God isn't in favour of, and God is not in favour of.
God is not in favour of? How do you know that?
Because he tells us.
Where?
In the written word. In 1 Corinthians 6, read it. 1 Corinthians 6, 19 to 20, it says...
1 Corinthians
6, 9, verses 19 to 20.
Okay, and who wrote that?
And also, it is godly inspired.
No, who wrote 1 Corinthians verse 19-20?
The Corinthians, and the Bible is inspired by God and the Holy Spirit.
But who says so? The people in the Bible?
We're going to get into a total different issue here now.
Okay, I do. We are going mm-hmm. Down another road here. I need to take another break. 51551.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
And the calls are still coming in on this very emotive topic. Barbara Doyle, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie. Thanks for taking my call.
Where do you stand on this issue, Barbara?
I firmly believe in euthanasia. I really, really do. After seeing what my mother went through for 10 years.
And tell me about your mother's situation.
Well, my mother was diagnosed with dementia at 55. Totally out of the blue. Like we had noticed a few things, but never thought it was this.
I think that terrorises people, the idea of a dementia diagnosis so young.
Yeah. And, you know, she was diagnosed fairly quick because we had noticed a few things. But, like, you're going back 25, 26 years ago because she's dead 17 years. But my mother went from being an agile person to running a home, going to shops, into town, to basically in a bed, in nappies, with a peg feed into her stomach. Absolutely knew nobody. I spoke to your researcher yesterday, went into the fetal position because her muscles had become so tight from lack of movement. So, it's, you know, choice is a great word. And I do think we should all have the choice. And I'm only going back from knowing my mother the way I knew her. If she had seen herself lying in a bed the way she was, there's absolutely, I have no doubt in my mind, she would have said, I want to end this. I can't do this.
Did you care for your mother during these years, Barbara?
I cared for her. My family cared for her. My sisters and brothers, who were wonderful. My father and a very, very good friend of ours that we got in. You know, we wanted to go to kind of like social occasions or weddings or things like that. We couldn't take her, obviously. So this girl we brought in as a bit of private care, and she was fantastic to my mother, you know. So without that support, I don't know where we would have been.
The sense I'm getting, and you're not the first caller or listener today that we've spoken about this, we had Pat on earlier on talking about mm-hmm. his parents and his
yeah.
uncle, that if when you actually have to be at the bedside and witness the situation that some people have to go through for years at the end of their life, that
yeah.
that this can, that it has given, certainly yourself and Pat earlier, a very strong view on the idea of assisted dying.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you walk into a room and this person can't even talk to you. This person can scratch their nose. Now, I know everybody goes through different stages of dementia, but my mother, to me, went through every possible stage of it. I mean, she'd had a heart attack in between this, and we didn't know. She didn't know she'd had it. And it was only when a few days later she was continuing to vomit that we got an ambulance. And they were able to tell us she'd had a heart attack on the Wednesday, and this was a Saturday. So she wasn't able to tell us what pain she was in.
It is. It's a horrific, horrific time for any family to live through.
It is, and it's, you know, it's soul destroying for them, for everyone that looks at it from a different point of view. Life is life. We all know that. But for someone that is in constant pain and can, as some of your speakers have said, can't wipe their backside, can't go to the toilet, can't walk up the stairs. I mean, my mother couldn't even swallow anymore. So she loved a cup of tea. We couldn't even give her that anymore. And it was horrible.
Barbara, you know? Barbara, thank you for calling in with that. Frank Brown, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
You don't agree that this option should be there for people?
Well, I think it's really important that you distinguish what you're talking about, because Joe was a wonderful speaker. He spoke about not resuscitating someone as opposed to assisted euthanasia.
Yeah, this is an advanced care directive we were talking about.
Well, even not resuscitate. I mean, regularly, what happens when people are very, very sick in hospital, they may not be able to give their wishes and preferences, and the family will be met by a doctor. I work in the health service. I'm a mental health social worker, and I care for my own mother with early dementia. But at some stage, the doctors in the hospital will say, we don't feel we should resuscitate this person if they become unwell. And a lot of families would say that's fair enough, because the person is dying over the next 3 weeks, 6 weeks. That's very different. Euthanasia is saying that somebody else is going to make a decision for someone else who may or may not have the capacity to express an opinion.
Or else
it's somebody who may be feeling quite depressed. And if you look at the cases in Belgium where someone says, I work with people who are very depressed, and they often say, life's not worth living. I want to go to Switzerland and end my life. And with counselling, with support, people can get through a difficulty. So it's one has to be really, really careful about what you're wishing for, because we do have a healthcare system that now has Fair Deal. That wasn't there a number of years ago. We are arguing strongly in my professional body for home care packages. Des O'Neill often talks about it's palliative care. There is absolutely no need for anyone to be in pain towards the end of their lives. Ultimately, it's how we manage to cope with a difficult period in our lives.
But is it... can I just stop you for 1 second, Frank, there?
Yeah,
and two points. One is, you did say that euthanasia, which is possibly other people making a choice about when somebody's life is going to go. I don't think that is one aspect. I don't think that's what we're discussing. We're talking about people with perhaps a terminal illness, living in great pain, making that decision for themselves.
But euthanasia will include the previous speaker you were talking to talked about their mother who had severe dementia, who was in a bed. And at that stage, I think the impression she was giving that she or the state should intervene and end the life now rather than waiting another year. I think you have to be clear what euthanasia means. Euthanasia means that you can actually, for example, you may say, a doctor will say, your mother is very unwell. Do you want the option of ending her life? Or you say to someone, in a year's time, you're going to be very unwell. Do you want to end your life? Ultimately, it's a difficult decision, and people making difficult decisions when they're emotionally upset or depressed. And your previous speaker, I think Damien, talked about feeling a burden. And that's why many people I know have concerns about euthanasia. Nobody's a burden. My mother was never a burden. My father was never a burden. The patients I work with are never burdens. What they need is somebody to make their life as meaningful and to support them through the... There are many, many disabled patients listening to your show who have to have home care to help them in all sorts of things. They want to live each day, but they want to live quality lives. It's about the health service funding home care packages, day centres, and support workers to give people quality lives, and supporting families at that last year where someone is coming to the end of their life with high quality care. The fear is, once you implement it, for some cases, you'll end up with something like what happens in Belgium. Young people depressed, wanting to end their lives, and being facilitated by the state. That's my concern. I can, the hard cases, I would have as much sympathy as anyone else. But not resuscitating someone and giving them palliative care is the key, surely.
Can I make the point here, and this is Dana speaking, you mentioned me earlier on. Can I be very clear? If you look up the proposed legislation from John Halligan, it takes into account that it would not be available to people who are suffering from depression or mental illness. That's point number one. Point number two, what we're talking about here is an individual who beforehand, before they get into a situation, they will actually turn around, like I want, I'm going to go and see my solicitor in the next month or so, and I'm going to put out, let's say, this is what I want in the case of anything happening to me. I've already told my children that. Okay? And that is my decision. And I should be able to do that. And the legislation actually does all that. If you look at the legislation, what they're proposing, and again, if the legislation is proposed again and it's being debated in the Dáil, all these things can be taken into account and then acted on as a result of a majority in the Dáil. And I'm sure people like yourself will make that decision.
Okay, so Frank, will you hold that thought for one moment? I just want to take one quick last break, but please stay with us.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Now we are almost out of time. In fact, we practically are out of time. Frank, 30 seconds if you want to respond there to Damien.
Yeah, very quickly. John Halligan is not a mental health professional. John Halligan, in terms of depression, we often don't know people are suffering with depression. Depression can take quite a long time to happen. So this notion that someone who feels a burden, feels that their life is, that they're afraid of the future. Father Tony Coote's a really great example of someone who was very upset, very depressed by his illness. Okay, he made a decision that he wanted to live the last moments of his life. My other concern is, if people say, well, if anything terrible happens to me, I want to die, and that's written somewhere, and 3 years later something terrible happens and they actually don't want to die, but they've lost the ability to communicate, are really, really great concerns that
I am sorry to cut across you, but we're going to have to go. We have got your point, though, and I thank you for coming on to make it. And that's it for today. BCO today was Laura Lee Davis. Mark McGraw was on sound. Research was by Richie Byrne. Angus McAnally produced, and Ray Darcy is next.